I want to begin by taking you back to one of the 20th century stories that has most impacted my own thinking in recent years. It's the story of a young Dutch woman in Amsterdam in the 30s and 40s by the name of Etty Hillesum, a Jewish intellectual, a young woman who'd studied languages and philosophy, was particularly fascinated by the Russian language, and actually was making a living in her mid-20s as a teacher of Russian, somebody whose Jewish heritage didn't matter a great deal to her. It wasn't a religious family, and she was quite interested in what we might now call New Age-style spiritualities and healing techniques. She was fascinated by psychoanalysis. She led what people like to call a full and rich life, that is, she had lots of affairs. And her life was generally not what you'd expect from somebody who was just about, unknown to her, to become a really rather significant figure in the religious life of the 20th century. We know about her because of the journals and letters that were collected and eventually published many, many years after her death. The complete version was only published about 10 years ago, I suppose. But if ever you come across a book with the name of Etty Hillesum on it, it's worth it. She was in Amsterdam when the Germans invaded. And so, of course, being Jewish, she was eventually, with her family and some of her friends, rounded up at Westerbork, the transit camp for Auschwitz. The last of her letters is something that she passed through the slats in the train as they started moving people out from Westerbork to Auschwitz, where she died a few months later. In the letters that she wrote and the journal entries she made in the last few months of her life, two themes are beginning to come into focus for her. The first is that she discovered, to her horror and amazement, that she felt she had to kneel down sometimes when she was in her room on her own. "I don't quite know what's going on," she said, "and I always said that I would never kneel down. It's one of those things that, you know, stupid religious people do." And yet, in the middle of the appalling tension and fear, the brutal oppression that was going on in Amsterdam, she felt she had to make some physical gesture of acknowledging the fact that the universe was not controlled by the Nazis. So she knelt down, not knowing what she was kneeling to, and not knowing if she was speaking to anybody or if anyone was speaking to her, but knowing that she just had to kneel down. It's a small thing, but she writes about it again and again. She returns to it again and again in her journals because she's surprised at herself and rather shocked. She, free-thinking, free-living, 20th century intellectual, suddenly doing this bizarre, exotic, religious thing. And the second thing that sort of bore in upon her in those last months is again what she describes in the last journal entries and some of the very last letters she ever wrote. She said there she'd never been religious, but she'd come to the conclusion, and this is her phrase, "Somebody's got to take responsibility for God in this world." And by that she meant that in a world where dehumanizing forces were at work everywhere, where everything seemed to be moving towards ironing out humanity itself, somebody had to take responsibility for living as though there were another frame of reference, another set of standards, another reality, once again, not controlled by Hitler. Somebody's got to take responsibility for God in this world. Somebody's got to live as though all those things tied up in the language of God were really true after all. All those things about profound self-emptying respect for the image of God in humanity, all those things about forgiveness and reconciliation, and all those things about behaving humanly even when there seems nothing to hope for. And so she went off to Auschwitz. The woman who'd learned to kneel down and the woman who decided to take responsibility for God in this world. And I talk about Etty Hillesum, indeed I talk about her probably far too much because she's such a compelling figure. I talk about her because very often when we hear language about faith, the first things that might come to our minds are slightly odd opinions held by individuals with whom, fortunately, we don't have too much to do. As I've sometimes said, faith in the language of government and administration, faith tends to mean exotic people, usually with beards and funny clothes, who are a bit of a social nuisance one way or another, and if you don't take great care, they'll kill each other, and if they don't kill each other, they'll probably kill you, so you've got to be very nice to them and also very careful with them. And that's faith. You'll understand why I'm not completely convinced by that version of things. And you may understand why, having started with Etty Hillesum, I think there's a bit more to be said about faith than that. In the case of that extraordinary woman, faith wasn't just a strange, exotic opinion that you hold in your head. Faith was something that radically changed what you thought you were, where you thought you were, what sort of world you thought you inhabited, and what sort of message you wanted your life to communicate. Etty Hillesum, in her last days, was asking, you could perhaps put it this way, what do I want to mean? Not so much what's the meaning of my life, but what do I want it to mean? Do I want it to communicate some of those things that historically have been bound up with talking about God, those things which are deeply under threat in this world where it looks suspiciously as though the forces of inhumanity are winning? Do I want to communicate a message of resistance? A message, it doesn't have to be like that. A message that there's another frame of reference in which the whole of our world just might be seen. Well, now you could say, and some people do say, that it's all very well to tell stories about extreme situations like the Nazis in Amsterdam. What actually does that have to do with the UK in 2010? Now, I agree it's dangerous to take the dramatic stories and just read straight across to where we are now. And one of the sad things that we do these days, I'm afraid, as Christians and people of other faiths, is to make too much of the fact that we think of ourselves as victims, and we sound in society at large as though we're whinging rather a lot. And that, you know, that's one of the issues we really ought to be tackling, but that's our problem. We're not in a state of persecution. We're not being rolled over by the tanks of inhumanity. And God willing, we're not very likely to end up in an extermination camp. God willing, you never know. People were saying that sort of thing in 1929, of course. But the crossover is something like this. We are in a society where, in many ways, bits of our imagination, bits of our sense of possibility, are shutting down. A society where consumerism, short-term perspectives, Elaine's talked about what some of those mean in climate terms, all of those things are actually making us live rather more intensely and unremittingly in the moment, with our needs, our desires, very much to the fore of how we think, as individuals and as societies. And that means that there are bits of our humanity that don't seem to have anywhere to go. The bits that get stirred into life when we're faced with the horrors of a world of intense poverty and widespread hunger, the world that Richard was talking about, but also the bits of ourselves that are deeply traumatized by bereavement, by depression, by many of those things that knock us sideways, and sometimes, of course, by joy and fulfillment and love as well, because those things also knock us sideways. In a world where the human options sometimes seem to be closing down or shutting down, what about those bits of ourselves that are not so easily dealt with in terms of the consumerist short-term society? Where do they go? One of my former students likes to say that the church is the place you put things that don't go anywhere else. Now, anyone who's ever seen the inside of some church vestries will know that that can be literally true in a very problematic way, but I pass over quickly to the more significant sense of church being a place where those bits of your humanity that tend to get left out of the equation in other parts of your life, other parts of the world, where they can go, where something can happen to them, where you can face them without embarrassment or fear, and you can be encouraged to do something with them and move forward. Faith, in other words, the Etty Hillerson sort of faith, can help to make space in the world where you can put the bits of your humanity that won't go anywhere else. And as a result of that, actually become something more like fully human. And it's only in that context, I think, that you start talking about what people believe. It's important, it's extremely interesting, and it's vital for the whole thing to go on. But if you start by asking, well, what are the opinions that religious people have, or what are the beliefs they have, you may never quite get to what seems to me the crucial point. What is it like to live a life of faith, to kneel, to take responsibility for God, to make space in the world for things that won't go anywhere else? I had a friend, now dead, alas, who was for 26 years the senior consultant psychiatrist at Broadmoor, the criminal mental hospital. His daily work was with mostly psychotic killers. He managed to get the Royal Shakespeare Company to visit Broadmoor, and he, with some of them, wrote a wonderful book about the experience of performing Shakespeare in front of an audience of psychotic murderers, and why Macbeth proved to be not quite what they'd thought it was in that sort of context. It was, you know, all in a day's work, so to speak. But Murray Cox, this wonderful psychiatrist, used to say his favorite line in the whole of Shakespeare was from The Tempest, "What seest thou else? You know what you see routinely, but what seest thou else? What else can you see?" As soon as you settle down with thinking you've seen what there is to see about human beings, you're in danger of closing down the options, closing down the imagination. Faith is one of those crucial things that allows you to see something else, not something extra, but to be in touch with some depth or dimension of reality which changes the whole landscape, allows you to see that it doesn't have to be like this, that human beings are more than they seem to be, that the future is not a closed repetition of the past. And that, I think, is part of what Etty Hillerson was talking about. To take responsibility for God is to live in such a way that it looks as though there's something else to see. Not a little extra religious bit of reality, but something that casts light on everything and reshapes the landscape and the lives of people around you. And while, as I say, we're not living in Amsterdam in 1944, thank God, we are living in a world where the closing down of the imagination is real enough. The closing down of the imagination and often of compassion too, back to what Richard was saying. Do we need something that keeps that else, that something else, open? I think we do. How exactly we talk about it, how we organize it, how we relate to it, there will be, I guess, several hundred different opinions in this hall. But we might at least ask the basic question, do we need that dimension? Do we need somewhere to put the things that won't go anywhere else?